Welcome back to the Doctor Is In podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nadia Saba, president and founder of Dr. Greenhouse. Today is Veterans Day, and in honor of our military vets, I'm interviewing a former Navy vet who transitioned his career from the military to the cannabis industry. John Libby was a machinist mate for 5 years and now works as the general manager at Connected California. Before that, he worked on Cresco's engineering team, which is how we met. During a site visit to their Massachusetts facility, we got to spend an afternoon together running around Boston and Harvard Yard and, you know, buying t-shirts and taking photos. It was a beautiful spring day. And during our conversations, I was struck by how valuable his military experience was to meeting the day-to-day and long-term challenges of operating an effective and efficient cannabis cultivation facility. I also had a ton of fun talking tech and engineering in the evolving cannabis space. As we know, it has changed a lot in the last 5 years or so. And in some ways, I would say today is my excuse to continue that super fun conversation. John, thank you so much for being my guest on this special episode to honor veterans in the U.S.
Oh my God, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I just want to ask you, why the Navy?
You know, it's a good question. So, you know, growing up, my dad was a Marine, you know, and I knew my whole life that I'd end up in the military. And honestly, I had a Marine poster on my wall for years as a child. I definitely thought that was going to be my route. You know, and then as I got through high school, I just kind of realized, you know, my interests took more of a technical turn than just, you know, grunt combat. So, and obviously every branch has, you know, different things to offer, different rates, things like that. But really it just turned out, the Navy seemed like they had both the mix of the technology and kind of that exploration, that travel the world kind of deal. So, the Navy was the choice, and specifically submarines, and you know, the rest is history.
Did you always like submarines? Like, do you like the water?
I mean, you know, I was a beach kid growing up, right? Definitely had interest in the ocean, but yeah, the submarines, that was the dumb kid side of me. When you get into the recruiter's office and they say, hey, you make an extra $150 a month if you go to submarines, I was like, sign me up. So
wow,
that's how we got in there.
How long would you be underwater for in a submarine?
So it depends, right? It depends on the kind of submarine. There's two kinds. There's your ballistic missile submarines that they really just kind of go out for 3 months, come back for 3 months. So it's a regular schedule, but they also don't get the Liberty ports, right? Which is kind of that's what you need somewhere that's going to pull into different ports if you want to explore the world. So boomers weren't for me. That's what we call them, boomers. So I was on fast attack submarines, started on the USS Pittsburgh. And it's completely random. So you could go out for a week, you could go out for a month, you know, come back in for 2 days, go right back out for another month. It was just completely random operation tempo. The first year I was in, we spent 9 months out of the first 12 months out to sea. So, and just really kind of random. And then once every 2 years, you toss in a 6 month deployment into that mix. So, and then you're gone for the full 6 months, not necessarily underwater the whole time, but you are gone for 6 months. The fun question I get asked often is how long was the longest I was underwater? The answer to that was 92 days. Spent 92 days without seeing the sky.
What's that like?
You know, it's
you
really
just get
funny.
Used to it.
You, I guess you get used to it, right? You're with your I'll say friends, with your coworkers down there, and they help you through it. You know, there's a lot of coaching, of course. There are times where, you know, tensions can rise, but for the most part, everybody helps everybody through it. You don't see people freak out like you see in the movies or think you'd see. You just kind of get used to it. Yeah.
Do you rotate shifts? Like, how do you? Are you on a circadian rhythm, you know, for a 24-hour period?
That's a really good question. No. So now I'm not sure how they do now. I know they were toying with, you know, 24-hour schedule. When I was in on deployments, as soon as you leave port, right? You are now on an 18-hour day. So you have 6 hours where you're on watch, right? This is your main duty when you're underway, which is, you know, for me, as auxiliary man of the watch was the name of my watch. You're the one in charge of going around and checking pressures, right? On hydraulics, pneumatics. You just make sure everything's okay with the ship, right? So, I mean, you have a clipboard of an absolute 100 metrics that you have to go around and make sure things are within spec. But there's all kinds of different watches underway. You can drive the ship, right? That's they call it helms and planes. It's actually a junior watch. So it's like the first thing you do when you get to the ship is drive it.
Really?
always a fun fact.
There's not that many things to hit, I guess, underwater. It's hard to make a mistake.
Yeah, well, people have proven that otherwise, but USS San Francisco, check it out. But no, there's, so that's the first 6 hours you do kind of your core responsibility. Then you have the next 6 hours is what you call off watch. There are some duties and responsibilities in off watch, but this is generally your time where you're going to watch a movie, take a shower, whatever. My off watch responsibilities were what we call shooting trash. You basically take the trash of the ship, put it in a compactor. And then my job is to take this pellet, essentially this packed in pellet, and shoot it out of the bottom of the submarine just to live on the bottom of the ocean floor. So sorry about the environment, but so that's your off watch duties. So, and of course, depending on your rate and your watch, those duties, they kind of change. And then the next 6 hours to complete the 18 hour cycle is it's really the time that you're supposed to sleep. So, and then it all starts over, right? So you are not on a 24 hour day, you're on an 18 hour day, and it can mess with you. You get back in and you find out like now you're trying to sleep and live on this 18 hour rhythm, and you find yourself awake at 2 o'clock in the morning thinking it's time to wake up, you know? So
wow.
It's a little hectic. Yeah.
That's way worse than having jet lag, I would imagine.
It's yeah. Especially when you do it for 90 days at a time. You
know? Oh my God. Okay. Where was the coolest place? Where's your favorite place that you visited?
Favorite place. I got to go through the Panama Canal, which is really cool. I also got to go to Brisbane, Australia. I've got to say that probably takes the cake. Brisbane was just an amazing place, and they were really, really excited to see an American over there. We weren't super common.
Nice. I've been watching, I watched this movie recently. I can't remember what it was called. It was from like the 60s, and it was about a submarine that went up to the Arctic, and they were looking, they were trying to get to the station up in the Arctic, and they were trying to find, like, they had to navigate like between all the, like the ice that was kind of underneath the water. And then they had to find like a place where the ice was shallow enough that they could like pop up through the ice. And yeah, it was really cool.
They still do that. So the ship I was on had what you call fairwater planes. So when you see the top of the ship, and essentially they look like wings going along the top of the submarine when it's on the surface sticking out. Newer ships got rid of those, and they move those control surfaces down to the bow of the ship, the front of the ship. So they kind of stay underwater all the time. Those ones that don't have the wings, they can obviously punch up through the ice. Ours would have it would have torn those wings right off of it. So
very so interesting.
But it's there's actually what's that guy's name? He's got a YouTube channel. He actually did a really in-depth Smarter Every Day channel. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Some people have, I'm sure, but he does a really in-depth kind of documentary style episode where he dives deep into submarines, submariners, and what they do. It's a good look. It's a good watch.
Okay, so if you guys want to learn more about life on a submarine and how they submerge and unsubmerge, what's the opposite of submerge?
Surface.
Oh, of course, yes, yeah, surface.
I get it, exactly.
So, how long were you in the Navy?
I was in the Navy for 5 years.
Okay, and why did you leave the Navy?
You know, it's funny. Obviously, like most people, I wanted to be able to pay for college, all that. And when I got out, I had every intention of going back. In the military, there are two different worlds, and that is officer or enlisted, right? So when you go out of high school, you don't have a college degree, you're enlisted, right? So you're either way, you're signing your life away. But As an officer, you come in and the treatment's just really different. You know, officers, they have to go through different school. Like they don't go to boot camp, right? They'll go to like OCS, officer candidate school. And they just generally throughout life, like imagine doctor versus nurse is kind of the way I've heard it before. You know, they just have more education and more leadership skills through like their boot camp, right? But for the most part, they're just generally the decision makers, and really they get the good beds. So I had every intention on leaving, going and get my degree, and then going back into the Navy. It just didn't work out that way.
All right. So you did go to college, right? After the Navy. Okay. And so how did you make this transition or this move towards the cannabis industry?
So it's, you know, I had quite the adventure when I got into my undergrad. So when I left the Navy, I did have like an associate's degree in computer science, just kind of this thing I worked on, you know, while I was still active duty. And then I was stationed in Pearl Harbor, when Hawaii, when it was all said and done. So I had the opportunity to stay in Hawaii and go to the University of Hawaii. So obviously I was like, well, that doesn't sound like a bad gig. So I did that, but Hawaii being expensive as it is, I got about 3 years through the degree, and I really just had to transfer back home. So I went back to work, but with the experience that I had in the Navy and some of the electrical experience that I'd had, I couldn't afford to go back into the Navy at that point, right? I was just climbing up in the trades electrically. I had too much experience. So it would have been a real big pay cut to go back in the Navy. Obviously, benefits and everything. You know, I was 24 years old, not the smartest person in the world at the time. But, you know, the decision was to stay out of the Navy and just keep working.
You can have too much technical experience to be in the Navy.
You know, the Navy is it's a really good place to jumpstart a career, stuff like that. And you'll see this happen a lot. People get out and they find out the private world just kind of pays better. So there's more to staying in the Navy than just the money, right? That's really what it comes down to. Like if you're after that, you know, adventure, honor kind of thing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, those are the kind of people you see stay in the Navy. For me, it was money and family, you know?
Yeah. So in your path to the cannabis industry, I mean, that doesn't seem to me like a natural direction to go from the Navy to, you know, to go from a federal sort of agency, right? To something that is maybe it is at this point illegal at the federal level. And moving towards an industry that may be shunned by, say, a federal, you know, agency that you worked for and were so closely knit to. Did you have, as you were considering cannabis, and I want you to tell us how you got into that, but was that a challenge for you, just your perceptions of cannabis and marijuana and how it was perceived or the attitudes towards it in the military, and before you got into it? Like, did you have a struggle? Was there a struggle there or no?
You know, I was, so my father was a cop, right? So I, you know, I was raised kind of with that mentality, and not that I was ever anti-cannabis, but I was never a user of cannabis until literally the day I got out of the Navy. You know, in the military, there's a completely different stigma. It's the popular opinion to not be a fan of cannabis in the military, at least when I was in, right? So we're still talking about over 10 years ago. So, you know, when I got out, and I tried cannabis literally that day, I kind of immediately fell in love. And, you know, that's a big reason that, like, things like that, the little things they say are kind of a big reason that people don't go back, like having to shave twice every day. Right. Like that's another brutal aspect that honestly went into a big decision of not going back into the military for me. Cause I mean, if 4 o'clock comes around, you're still at work and the face hair is long, you're shaving. So,
but you have a 6 hour period in which you have like your downtime. So you'd like shave in like minute one and then shave in like minute, what, 60 times 3,600 minute.
Right. Right. Yeah. You get it. You get it. And it's not by choice, right? It's usually somebody who's more powerful than you coming and getting in your face saying, hey. And then obviously, you know, pursuing an engineering degree after the Navy, you know, what are your aspirations when you're an up and coming engineer, right? You're thinking NASA, you're thinking Boeing, and a lot of these companies that, you know, their entire revenue is built off of federal contracts. Cannabis is essentially, you know, it disqualifies you. So, which is unfortunate, right? Especially when, you know, I did finally get around to finishing my degree and I was looking at engineering jobs, and oddly enough, and this is how I got into cannabis, I just posted my resume in a job board for Submariners, right? It was just like a Facebook group. And you know, I posted it out there just to see, and a friend of mine, somebody actually knew from the Navy, reached out to me to say, hey, there's this job in Arizona, this engineering job, like, you know, it's for a cannabis company, right? And I swear, the minute I read that, I was like, oh, you know, I can't do that, right? Like, I'm giving up NASA, I'm giving up Boeing, I'm giving up, you know, Northrop, right? So I was like, but then I looked at it, I looked at the money too. So, and I was, you know, I was, the experience that came with the job, there was just so much responsibility that came with an engineer in a cannabis company, because I feel like it's so difficult for them to find good engineering talent. And what was good about me and my degree is I got my experience first. You know, like I was in facility maintenance and facility engineering before I finished my degree, right? Like at this point I'd been working for the city of Charlotte for 5 years, working on conveyor belts and jetways, you know, and all the controls associated with that. So here I am coming into the cannabis industry with a resume, with experience and an engineering degree. And they scooped me up quick.
I imagine that they would snatch you up quickly. You know, you had mentioned electrical being sort of your sweet spot. Is that typical for a submariner? Are there multiple different types of engineering disciplines within sort of the submarine task force?
Yeah, so there definitely are. And the Navy compartmentalizes big time, right? So there's no cross training. If you're, you know, you can be a mechanic is what they call them. It's actually an engineering rate. They just kind of give weird, like I was a machinist mate. It was my rate, right? I never did any machining in the Navy. So they're weird with their names, but you have your electricians, you have your mechanics, you've got auxiliary mechanics, which is what I was. And then you've got like ELTs, nuclear chemists, essentially. They're all considered engineering in the Navy, and there's no sharing of responsibility, right? So like, I mean, we're talking, if a light bulb goes out, a mechanic does not change a light bulb. An electrician changes the light bulb in the Navy. So
that's so crazy to me that you're so siloed in such a small space.
And it's like, there are different watches that you can qualify for that would generally be outside of your responsibilities. So I'm not saying there's, you know, some go-getters out there that could expand into other realms, but for the most part, it's that compartmentalized. You will not see a mechanic change a light bulb.
But you get to choose your compartment?
Kinda. You choose when you're in MEPS before you join the military, you actually join, you know. But but once you're on that track, you're really kind of stuck in it. And I was kind of victim to that. So, you know, I did really well in the ASVAB. So I generally had a pick of whatever I wanted to do. But I, you know,
what's the ASVAB?
What's the that? Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test. I can't believe I still know that. But it's basically, it's the SAT for the military.
Okay.
Right. So you take this, depending on your score, it decides on what you can do. I scored an 84th percentile. So it was all right, you know. I essentially had a choice to do whatever I wanted to do. And at the time, I was like, you know, well, this is engines and, you know, hydraulics and all that. So I dove right in. And I later tried to change that. And it's incredibly difficult to change after you pick. So, and a lot of people listening probably attest to that. So yeah, so it's compartmentalized. And in that, you know, I had gotten down the road of, you know, kind of strictly mechanical. And I didn't really know anything about electrical when I was in the Navy. So when I got out, I was like, well, I don't know anything about it. So electrical engineering was the route I took. So then I would
Nice.
no longer not know anything about that. And yeah, 3 years of engineering school in Hawaii, electrically oriented. I learned a lot.
Okay, so now fast forward, you apply for this job with Cresco, I'm assuming, right? And you're working for them. I mean, what was it like? Did you have a culture shock going from the sort of regimented, siloed, this is what you're going to do, and this is all you're going to do. And sort of that, what am I, that culture, and then switching over to one, cannabis culture, but two, just not the military culture. What was that like for you?
So I mean there'd been a few years at that time. I think there was about 6 years I'd been out of the military before I got picked up at Cresco. And you know, I was a huge stoner in college in Hawaii, right? So that it really kind of brought me back to those days. Yeah, I think just that 6 years being out of the military was enough to not completely culture shock me.
Okay.
But at the same time, you know, I had been working for the city of Charlotte, which is small government, anti-weed, drug tests all the time. That's North Carolina, where I think weed will be forever illegal. You know, so I still had to make this switch from East Coast to West Coast, you know, lush green North Carolina to desert.
Yeah.
And you know, weed totally unacceptable socially to everyone smoking weed on the street. I mean, it was a culture shock. There's no doubt about it. But really, with the core of the responsibility of that job being, you know, facility engineering and facility maintenance, even I just kind of that's my strong suit, you know. So I just kind of fell right in. The team that I had at Cresco was unbeatable. Shout out to Matt Welland. He was my boss when I got there. He's an engineer right now. He's in St. Louis, comes from power generation. The man is a genius. He was a, you know, a, it was just a privilege to be able to learn from him for the first few years we were there. And then, you know, after that, the comfort that I had from him, getting in, getting comfortable, I hit the ground running. And we immediately started spending money, making some changes to that facility here in Arizona.
So what did you learn? What did you take away from your time at the Navy and the experiences and the skills that you had in the Navy? And what was immediately applicable to your new job responsibilities at Cresco?
So this is something I think a lot of people would agree with, but they won't say out loud, and that's getting through 5 years in the military teaches you to put up with a lot of bullshit, right? So I mean between the schedule, the op tempo of deployments, the people you work with, the people who lead you, right? I mean, you don't have a choice in any of these things, and the military is different, right? I can't quit. I can't call in sick. I can't you know, I can't wake up in the morning and say, yeah, I don't feel like going today, right? I can't be 5 minutes late. You know, like that's you're 5 minutes late to work when you're in the Navy is it's a lot different than the civilian life. So you know, after and I say putting up with that, you know, there's not a I'm so grateful for the experience and the time that I had in the Navy. I'm just also glad it's over kind of thing. But that professionalism that you learn there, the work ethic that you learn when you're forced to put or go through all this stuff, it makes everything on this side easy. You know, showing up to work on time is simple. Just tracking and getting your duties done every day makes it easy. So, and then, you know, of course, we all work for somebody, right? So, and being able to put up with everything on that side of things is invaluable.
I love that where you went to with that question was not a technical answer. It was more of a human answer, right? Like the human experience answer.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, of course, we could get through the technicals. I mean, the reality of things is, you know, the submarine I was on was built in 1984. It wasn't the newest, best technology that you think, but it was the tested over time, reliable, functioning technology, right? So, and it's kind of the basics. So you go through, and I'm telling you, anybody on that submarine, and I think that's what makes submarines so different from everything else, is everybody on that sub knows how it works. You know, so you'll get into other rates in the Navy and other branches of the military where you learn your job. You just kind of know that on a submarine, everybody knows how to put out a fire. Everybody knows how to stop flooding. You know, everybody knows your hull and backup valves, right? Where the water comes in.
I hope so.
Because it doesn't, whoever's closest, it's going to be up to them. So, it was kind of a unique experience being in subs and learning that side of things too.
How can those skills transfer to the cannabis industry, or how have you seen those types of skills or similar skills within the industry? Or do you feel like, or is cannabis also more or less siloed or compartmentalized, or are there certain things that you see that are shared within the cannabis industry, or at least what your roles have been there, that could actually maybe benefit the military? Like, are there certain things that you like the way things are done in the roles that you've been in civilian life that could have positive benefits in the military?
Yeah. You know, I think there's definitely a bigger push for cross training, you know, especially, you know, like rate specific things or job specific things, in the civilian side. You know, I've seen, and in this industry, especially, I've seen bud tenders go on to be directors of marketing, right? Like, and that's 100% cross training. And you don't have that in the military, or at least in Navy and definitely submarines. Fun fact, they used to have this rate they'd call strikers, where you essentially join and see where you fit, right? I think they still do that on surface ships, but they don't do it on subs anymore. But I always thought that would be a really good way to get people in and kind of test out what they're good at, and then put them on the track, right? Instead of guessing as an 18-year-old coming out of high school, damn, like you're going to be an electrician now for years. So, I always liked that about the civilian side.
You don't have to declare your major right away.
Right. And even in college, like you have the ability to change a major, right? You don't necessarily have that in the military as easy as you think.
There was something you mentioned earlier. You said that you have to make in the Navy, when you're in your regular duties, like one of the things that you're doing is making sure that things were operating to spec. And I love that, because there's a lot of conversation, right, in the cannabis industry about measuring and metering and monitoring, right? You can't manage what you're not measuring, right? And I'm curious about that sort of crossover, and if you took that skill of, you know, checking the specs, checking the data, is it fitting within our tolerances, within our variances, and how do you make a minor change and not a sea change, right, within your day-to-day operations? Have you seen that sort of translate?
Yeah. So I think that's been something that's made me really successful in my career, in the cannabis industry, is that I think this industry as a whole lacks SOPs, right? In the Navy, if you get caught doing anything without an SOP in your hands, like you, it's going to be a problem. So, and I mean, these SOPs are detailed down to, you know, not only are you measuring, what are you measuring with? Is it calibrated? When was the last time it was calibrated? Is it still showing signs of being calibrated? I mean, they go down to the absolute T. Like, I mean, you know, make sure you're checking your change list, right? Make sure you have the most up-to-date SOP. And this is all just integrated from the get-go, from the beginning.
Why is that important?
Because, you know, if I'm reading an SOP, like, for example, the change log, this is something in quality assurance in the Navy, which is like a whole qualification. I was a qualified quality assurance inspector. So we went through all this whole thing, and their favorite thing to do is to have you read an SOP, go through the SOP, spend all the time that it takes to get through it, and then realize that you skipped the step in the beginning where you missed the change log. And now this SOP is out of date, and you basically performed a wrong SOP.
Oh shit.
So like, I mean, that's one of their favorite tricks. And you know, it just ingrains in your soul, like at every step of every procedure, every process, am I doing it right? Like, is this the right thing to do? And you know, there's no reading in between the lines with these SOPs in the Navy. But if there was, that's it, right? Like, you've got to know to look back at the beginning, right? Like, am I doing the right thing here? And it's, you know, people's lives depend on it.
Well, and maybe what you just said is key to that whole endeavor of SOPs, is people's lives depend on it. Though we could say that maybe in the cannabis industry or any other industry, that your livelihood, if not your lives, your livelihoods could, right, or should depend on following that protocol. One of my favorite shows is Air Disasters. And I love whenever there's like an emergency, right? Like, they're going through their checklist, right? There's a checklist for every single emergency, for every startup, for every shutdown, right, procedure. And they're literally going through this checklist, and you don't skip a step, right? And if you do skip a step, there's consequences associated with that. I mean, in the military, who writes those SOPs? Is it the users? Like, would you guys write SOPs? Would you update SOPs? Or is that coming from officers? Or is that coming from where?
So I'm sure that somewhere there's a room full of engineering officers that get a medal every time they find a typo or something like that. but the, you know, the written in blood aspect of the whole thing is that we do have the ability to submit changes, which go up, you know, this goes up to the fleet, right? And if there is a change implemented, it's a big deal because there's a lot of ships out there and a lot of things that have to change. But, you know, it's like an update to your computer, right? Like, you've got the little ones, you know, that you change maybe on a quarterly basis, something like that, you know, an update. But then you've got the major, like, procedural issues that you'll find where they issue like kind of an immediate, more important change. Those are rare. Only saw a few of those in my time. But yeah, to answer your question, is probably a group of overpaid military engineering officers that are drafting this all up.
Okay, so tell me now. I mean, now you work as a general manager for Connected California. And operations, you're in operations.
Yeah, weird.
How does that compare to what you're doing in engineering? And is it more closely related to maybe what you're doing on the submarine?
So weird. I guess I really thought about it like that, but it kind of is. So, you know, the last couple of years I was in with Cresco, I started to move into that operations role. Like, you know, they were, as things were winding down on the West Coast, Arizona specifically, its responsibilities started to get divvied up. So, you know, when I was working, you know, I give a shout out to a good friend of mine, Jim Keblinger. He was running operations for Arizona before they closed out. He taught me a ton. He taught me a lot as well. We had a regional president, Dave Gakeham. That guy, he just taught me everything. So the last couple of years in Cresco, I feel like I did gain a lot of those, you know, from kind of the business side of responsibilities. And, you know, I learned a lot in the last 2 years. But then, you know, to your point, when I got over here and, you know, I found myself managing 100 employees, you know, all departments of the facility, it was like, you know, it did bring me back to those military days where you have to, you know, you have to learn to work elbow to elbow with people, right? You've got to focus on the absolute attention to detail. You can't miss, you know, the the slight weight differences and production output, like, you know, those kinds of things. So while it's never really been something I did, you know, when you're working through engineering with numbers and capacities and things like that, like getting here was just really a matter of, you know, applying those numbers where they fit, if that makes sense. So, you know, you learn the attention to detail, you practice that. And that's key, is practicing that attention to detail. Like, everyone can say they have attention to detail when they're, you know, reading terms and conditions and I caught every word, but, you know, are you practicing this every day? Are you practicing it on the fly? And are you calling it out when you find it? You know, that stuff takes practice and experience. And I think it really, just with what I did in the past, it kind of rolled right in.
Nice, nice. So, I mean, what advice would you have for other veterans of any of our military branches who are interested in getting into the cannabis industry?
I would say be cautious, right? So it comes back to those goals. You know, do you ever want a federal job, right? If I drew a flow chart right now, and if the answer is no, then bam, get in the cannabis industry, right? But that's my first question. So if you want to get into federal contracts or federal, you know, work, probably not, the cannabis industry is probably not for you. But if you'd like something challenging, you know, rewarding, lucrative, and the best thing is this industry is new, right? You're not getting into, you know, somebody like Amazon, who's been doing it for 100 years and, you know, they've made a quadrillion dollars and they know how to do it, right? New ideas and new experiences are welcome every day in the cannabis industry. And, you know, there's new ways to do things in all regards, right? You've got manufacturing, cultivation, distribution, and then processing, and none of those things are written in stone on the right way to do it.
That's a really interesting response, that you don't necessarily have to be a yes man. You don't necessarily have to follow the instructions or the directions or directive that has been handed down from generation to generation to generation for good reason, right? Like, there's a reason why those processes and SOPs and directives are in place, right? To save lives, right? And to do everything the same way. Cause I'm assuming if you go from one submarine to the other submarine, right, you want everything to be the same. You don't want to learn a brand new submarine, right? So you had mentioned, like, SOPs. If you change something, it doesn't just change for your submarine, it changes for all the submarines that are out there, so that, right, you're not blindsided by something. But if you're looking for something in, I don't know, almost engaging, where you're almost required to be engaged with the process and come up with new ideas and new ways of doing things and new ways to be effective and efficient, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, this definitely checks those boxes, for sure.
More so than I've seen anywhere else. It's honestly refreshing.
You mentioned federal contracts. Are you basically, I mean, having worked in the cannabis industry, are you basically forbidden from switching careers back to a federal agency, or can you just be drug tested and kind of like wash yourself clean of it?
So, I mean, that's the thing, is it's, you know, there's nothing written in any policy that says if you worked in cannabis, you can't work here, right? But there's, you know, through security clearances and things like that, you're obviously not going to be able to hide it. And you're working with the stigma of, you know, dare I say, boomer. The people who run the show in those federal entities are rarely going to be the person that looks to, you know, even a senior leader in cannabis and say it's a good idea to bring them over. I'm not saying it's never happened. I'm not saying it can't happen. Just in my experience, from what I've seen, and I've seen lots of executives leave cannabis companies and go on to different places, and I've never seen one end up in at Boeing, right? So take that with a grain of salt. I'm not the expert on the matter. But
do you think rescheduling cannabis could change some of that?
Absolutely. So, like, that's the thing about, you know, these people that run these entities, you know, the senior leaders I knew in the military, right? Like, even my dad, who was a police officer, like, when it's legal, right? So they really draw the line right there, you know, with the word of law. You know, it sounds corny and tacky, but I just think that's really the reality of things.
Yeah. What would you say to employers, civilian employers, I guess, who are thinking about hiring a vet or are interested in hiring veterans for their staff?
Oh, like, you know, it would be my first preference, right? When you get a veteran, you know what you're getting, right? And I'm not saying all veterans are perfect, right? But you at least know that they made it through boot camp. You know that they made it through, you know, an enlistment that required work ethic. And that's really what it comes down to. Cause I don't care if you don't have the drive or the work ethic to be in the military, you won't make it. You won't make it 5 years. There's no way. It's just because you're tested every day. You know, I never worked longer hours than I did in the Navy, even when we were in port, you know? So just knowing that people can get through that, it's a lot like a college degree to me, where, you know, if, you know, somebody has a bachelor's degree, sure, does that guarantee they're a genius or they're gonna be the best employee? No, but you know that they have at least the dedication and drive to do the 4 years of work that it takes to get that degree. So it's not, you know, it's not the end all be all qualifier, but it's I wouldn't put that resume under the desk for sure.
Nice. Yeah. Grit and perseverance are what come to mind with what you've described. That, I mean, if you're under the sea, if you're submerged for 91 days, you can't walk off the job. Like you can't escape. I mean, I guess you could and take everyone with you.
And of course, it's job dependent too, right? Like, are you looking for a receptionist at a vet clinic, a veterinary clinic? You know, like maybe grit isn't the skill that you're looking for there, but yeah, you get what I'm saying.
I mean, I know your time was spent in the Navy. You have family that was in the Marines. Are there any certain skills or qualifications or experiences from the other military branches that might differ in terms of how they would be applied in this industry?
Well, it's funny you ask. I did spend 1 year with the Army. I volunteered for a deployment. I needed a break from submarines, so I decided to go to Iraq for a year.
Fun.
So I went, went with the Army. It was a unique experience. You know, I was wearing an Army uniform that said U.S. Navy on it, and that was a shock to a lot of people when I was over there. But I spent a year in Iraq, Camp Taji. It was 2009. And I was with the Army. So, you know, I learned a lot from those guys out there. You know, that was much more, that was obviously not a technical rate. We were in a combat zone, and it was just a unique experience. And, you know, you learn how to adapt quickly, from those guys. So, you know, shout out to all those guys I was with over there. And, but to answer your question, those branches have an awful lot to offer as well. You know, they do have their technical rates as well, just like the Navy has kind of their, you know, less technical rates, I'll say. You know, it's all about the person and what they do with kind of that experience that's given to them.
Nice. I guess if you can dodge bullets, you can dodge a lot of things in regular life, right?
Certainly put up with a high stress situation.
Yeah, there you go. You know, is there anything you'd like to add about how cannabis has affected your life or maybe the life of other veterans that you know?
Yeah, so recently our founder, one of our co-founders, Ted, he said in an interview, you know, the medical aspect of cannabis it's undisputed, right? Like the fact that it's even argued now is ridiculous. You know, you've got like the Charlotte's Web stuff, the stop seizures. That's definite, right? What is less talked about is, well, what if you're just the person that's a little on edge, right? Like what if you're the person that you just need, you know, a little bit of stress relief and it makes you totally like a completely different person tolerably. You know, it's not fair to disclude that, you know, or like that needs its attention too. So, and I think I might be one of those people, you know, maybe it was Navy, you know, maybe submarine, whatever it is, right? I feel like I could kind of be on the more serious side, I just need something to take the edge off, right? So at the end of the day, you know, when work and responsibilities are done, you know, you smoke a little bit of cannabis and bam, you're automatically the person you want to be. Like, I don't think it's fair that we take that from people, just because that's not some defined medical, you know, condition or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So that there is that, you know, I am not a proponent of cannabis at work, which is in this industry an unpopular opinion, which I get. But I don't think it makes you more alert or anything like that. You know, you're probably at your best when you're not stoned. But that doesn't mean it makes people's or it doesn't make people's life better on the regular basis. Right. So maybe it's more important that you do take the edge off and you're not the super serious, you know, maybe more aggressive person or version of yourself. And maybe that sacrifices a little bit of work ethic during the day. I'm not going to be the one to judge that person. So I think it's something that should be looked at and kind of considered.
I wonder how much, if at all, some of the efforts and some of the discussions around rescheduling cannabis do have to do with military vets. And you had mentioned, you know, the medical research is pretty solid at this point and how it can help with anxiety. It can help with, you know, getting off of opioids. It can help with, you know, just taking that edge off. And we know that a lot of our military vets have that edge. And so I wonder if there's almost if some of that push is coming internally from the military saying, look, we have, you know, this potential to serve our vets in a different way that right now is illegal, but could have a lot of benefits overall if we just kind of loosen up the reins a little bit and let our vets, you know, partake in something that is not dangerous, that will reduce our suicide rates and just, you know, make them, yeah, just take that edge off.
You know, I have to think that it's being discussed, right? But I think at the end of the day, the same people that are having that conversation are also responsible for the active duty guys. And so now they've got to say, well, if they can smoke weed, then we got to let the active duty guys smoke
Oh,
weed. And
damn.
you know, if it's legal, it's legal. And that's something that it's hard for me to imagine the military will ever give up. And that's letting active duty military, you know, partake in marijuana. Which is, I mean, that obviously they let them drink, you know.
I was just going to
But
ask that question. Are active military allowed to drink?
absolutely, yeah. There's quite a few nights I don't remember, but you know, it's tradition, I think, is really what
And
it
it's
comes
the
down
devil
to.
you know, right? I mean,
Yeah,
you know
exactly. Yeah.
how people are going to act and behave and react or not react when they're drunk, but there's not a lot of scientific research or experience that shows this is how my personnel is going to behave and react in an emergency situation if they're stoned as opposed to drunk.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we all, I think we all, we don't know what we're gonna do, but we know what we could do when we're drunk, right? So I guess there's some value in that. But, you know, the tradition is such a big thing in the military. I mean, all the way down to the uniforms we wear, like everything's based on tradition. Submarines, we don't even have brooms, right? Like this is because the handle of the broom could, you know, transmit sound from the deck plates to the walls and then I'm promise you, I've swept
Are you
more bullets on
serious?
hands and knees than you'd believe. So
Wait, so
it's a true story.
how do you keep the submarine clean, or do
With a
you?
foxtail, Nadia, you know, you gotta it's a little handheld little broom thing. And I promise you this is a real thing. There are no brooms on submarines. So
Because you could give away your position, like
you know, it
someone could
so
use sonar and find
honestly
you. Is that really what it is?
Newer submarines are so they're so sound isolated, you know. I think the risk of that is pretty low, but that's the argument behind it. So no
Wow.
brooms on submarines.
That is awesome. That might have to be the title.
No brooms on submarines. Yeah. So that's that Navy tradition there. You know, whether or not that's based on reality on the whole sound thing. But That's the tradition behind it. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, the military can tend to, or it seems like it can run around in circles just to follow tradition sometimes. But you know, I think cannabis might be falling into that category with the military.
Interesting, interesting. So what has cannabis taught you?
Ooh, so you know, honestly, this year's been it's been different. It's been a challenge. Up until here, you know, a lot of my responsibilities were just facility maintenance, right? So it was, you know, much less how can I optimize this plant growing, and much more, you know, well, cultivation wants this room to be able to get to 56 degrees. You know, how what are we going to do to get to do that? So up until this year, that's what I've been doing, but you know, I've learned a lot about the plant. You know, I've been a grower now of, you know, of my own cannabis for the 13 years I've been out of the military. So, but I mean, we've taken it to a whole new level, you know, when you look at it from a commercial standpoint. Obviously, you know, we could talk about the job stuff, right? Like you know, I learned a ton about, you know, heat loads and cooling capacities, things like that. And then even into, you know, this position now where it's production throughputs and, you know, labor allocation, things like that. But for the most part, you know, I think it's taught me to loosen up, right? You know, I was that uptight veteran. I had that mentality of, you know, as a leader in the military, you know, you get in a person's face and, you know, call them a dumbass right to their face, right? You can't do that. If I did that here, then everybody would quit, right? So my leadership has definitely evolved, much definitely for the better, no doubt about that. And I think that's a really special thing that the cannabis industry has done for me. And I'll definitely, wherever I go, wherever I end up, you know, I know as an engineer, there's lots of promising opportunities out there that are not in cannabis. But I know that if I end up somewhere else outside of the cannabis industry, they have the people that I've worked with and those that I've learned from, I mean, it's absolutely invaluable experience. And yeah, I'm just so grateful for it.
That's so awesome. I'm so glad to hear that. I feel a lot the same way. I didn't start in cannabis. It kind of, drew me in for, as an engineer, there was a need and, went to it. So, even through school and studying greenhouses and hydroponics and growing shiitake and oyster mushrooms, people would ask, "Oh, when are you going to grow the real stuff?" Right?
Right.
Well, it
Here we
finally
are
caught up
then.
to me.
You
Well, John,
it.
thank you so much for talking about your experiences as a member of the Navy and the work you did on the submarine and what you're doing now, as a veteran working in the cannabis industry. I want to have another conversation with you because I do, when we are geeking out in Massachusetts, we're talking a lot about HVAC and loads
Yeah.
and the mechanical engineering side of things. So I definitely want to return to that conversation before you forget it all as an operations
Right, right,
person.
right. I'm very much still involved, I promise you.
But yeah, I really think our listeners are going to enjoy this conversation and what you bring to the table and other veterans as well. Just out of curiosity, have you met other veterans in the industry who are doing similar work that you're doing or different work than you're doing?
You know, it's funny. We have a our director of sales just started here. He's on the second day. He's a Navy vet from around the same era that I was in as
That's
well. Now,
awesome.
besides him, it's been very few and far between. Definitely not a lot of leadership roles filled with veterans. So, if there are any veterans listening to this, just know that we got gaps and we need them filled with good talent. So, be on the lookout for that. But otherwise, you know, a lot of these. I do see a lot of veterans that are just getting out, coming into like logistics roles or, you know, distribution roles, things like that, like good positions, good that are filled with good people. So, but it has not been a lot. It has not been a lot.
Well, we need all the help that we can get. We know that states are still in the process of legalizing this plant and the cultivation and, you know, use of it. And, you know, there's probably a state where you live, I'm sure, that could use your skills and experience and grit and perseverance to get through what can be very challenging days. And in the, you know, this year has been pretty tumultuous for the industry. And it's a great time to get in and to bring your abilities and your expertise, I'd say, to an industry that could use people that are willing to sort of buckle down, right? And get it done and get it done right.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Not just here to pay, collect a paycheck, but actually contribute.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, thanks so much, John. It was really nice catching up with you. You know, you got to come visit me in Sacramento, and I should come visit you in Phoenix too.
Well, you know, I'll be back and forth between Sac and here, hopefully a bunch over the next year. So let's do that soon.
Let's make it happen. All right. Thanks, John. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks so much. Great to see you. Thanks,
Nadia. You too. Bye.